Every team, every topic, everywhere. This is Believe.
Time. There's nothing more valuable. It's what drives everyone to make the most of every moment. We celebrate living large in the now, in a city where time disappears. We create experiences that electrify the soul and memories that will last forever. We go big, we go all night, and here, everyone is invited. So get loose and get loud.
This is Circa. You'll have the time of your life.
This is the Arash Markazi Show on the Mightier 1090 ESPN Radio. Hard times
like that. Hello and welcome to the Arash Markazi Show, presented by the Sporting Tribune on the Mightier 1090 ESPN Radio in Southern California, 98.5 The Bet in Las Vegas, and the Hawaii Sports Radio Network, 95.1 FM and AM 760 in Hawaii. A lot to get into on a Friday. Let's not waste any time. Let's bring in from the Sporting Tribune, Grant Mona, Brandon Deutsch. Grant, we had to have you on the show because it is do or die, win or go home, all that, the great cliches in sports today for the Clippers as they head to Dallas to face the Dallas Mavericks, down 3-2 in the series. If they win, we got the most beautiful two words in sports. Game 7 Sunday at the Crypt. If not, their season is over. My friend, how are you feeling going into this crucial Game 6?
Just about as nervous and scared, I guess you could say, of the Dallas fans and that Dallas arena as you could be. Look, this is basically do or die of an era, honestly, if you're thinking about it. I mean, it could be. I know I'm talking in absolutes right now, but it's really could be a defining moment of this team's era, you know, this Paul George, Kawhi Leonard era. I know that I said and last yesterday's show that, you know, they'll probably run it back, but we don't know that. You know, we don't know what the mindset of the Clippers are. I'm just judging based off of the history. So, look, is it possible for the Clippers to win this Game 6? Absolutely. They just did it in Game 4 on the road. Paul George and James Harden were better on the road for whatever reason. They play better on the road. And look, with your backs up against the wall, I would expect those two to play great games. Obviously, I expected them to play great in Game 5, and that did not happen. But look, usually these two get up for these. I mean, if you kind of look at it, Game 4 was a little bit of a backs against the wall, do or die situation as well, because you never want to go down 3-1. And they showed up for that. So for whatever reason, they didn't show up in Game 5 at home in a pivotal swing game. But I'm cautiously optimistic for these two guys and this whole team to kind of rally in this Game 6. Now, I'm not predicting that they'll win, but I'm going to say that this game will be close. It will be intense. It will be probably another great classic game in the playoffs between these two teams.
So, Brandon, we didn't get a chance to chat with you following Game 5. Grant really did not hold back. It was one of the most embarrassing Game 5 performances for a team that, you know, 2-2 series, you're playing at home to get blown out by 30, totally, I mean, again, not expected. What did you see from that game, and do you think there will be carryover? One thing that Jason Kidd did say is that he thought there was carryover from Game 4-5. Again, the Mavs coming back from 30-plus points down to take a one-point lead. They didn't win, but he thought there was carryover in terms of the way that they played. The Clippers have to hope that that's not the case tonight. What did you see from Game 5, and would you be concerned that that will continue to Game 6?
I don't think it'll continue. I think the line is too high. It's like 7.5 Dallas.
Yeah.
I would never take 7.5 Dallas. I don't care that they won by 30. The Clippers are the weirdest team in history. They're the weirdest organization in history. Every time they get beat by 35 or 40, they'll come back and win a game down two players or down three players. Now, I'm not saying they're going to win this game because Kyrie Irving's 12-0 in closeout games in his career, by the way.
Incredible stat.
Yeah, it would. I mean, looking back, Rob was not cooking. He needed to trade two first-round picks. I mean, looking back, I would have loved Kyrie Irving on this Laker team. But at the end of the day, it's just going to be a close game. I doubt James Harden has another horrible game. I doubt Paul George has another horrible game to that extent. Russell Westbrook's probably going to have another horrible game because he can't shoot any. He hasn't been able to shoot in years. And when he's not making his shots at the rim, is really no playing him. I hate to say it. They got to play Bones Highland instead of him at this point. And I think at the end of the day, they have enough guys, like where if Terrence Mann is hitting the three, Norm Powell has experience. He's a player. He's a vet. You know, he knows what he's doing. Plumlee, I know he made a couple of bonehead decisions, but I still think he's good. Zubac has been killing them this season, this series. By the way, Zubac, I think, is going to have a career year next year. He just keeps getting better, which is like, you know, we've seen like this trajectory for him. That's a separate point. But I think next year is like what he's in his prime now. I think we're starting to see that in this series. I think it's going to be a close game. I would not be surprised if the Clippers win this game and lose at home in game seven. That'd be such a Clippers thing to do. So,
but you know what? Grant and I was talking about it and I forgot. I think, was it the 9-year anniversary, Grant, or the 10-year anniversary? I think it's nine, right? Again, I mean, that was the high watermark, I think, of the Lob City Clippers. I think the best Clippers moment is obviously when they blew out the Utah Jazz in game six, went on to their first ever conference final. But prior to that, again, they were down 3-2 to the defending champions. Again, a team with moxie, a team that had been there before. You know, you're going up against Tim Duncan and Manu Ginobili and Tony Parker and that team. They went into San Antonio amazingly, won that game, went back home game seven, and then Chris Paul hits that bank shot to win the series. Why, again, I know you're nervous, and I think we all think here that the Clippers have a chance again because they've done crazy things. Again, if you had told me before the series that Kawhi is not going to play, for example, in games one and four, I would not have predicted that they would have had a 30-point lead in those two games. What if they're to win, what needs to happen?
I think, Arash, they need to play with aggressiveness. They need to play with energy. They need to play with focus. This is a team that in game five looked like they didn't even want to be there. It looked like they had no pride. And that was just so weird from a team that all year has been talking about, well, we can flip the switch. Oh, just, we're going to wait for the playoffs. You know, this is a team that was primed to get to this point and they didn't do it. And like I mentioned, for whatever reason it is, they play their best basketball in road scenarios with their backs against the wall. I mean, there's a reason why a lot of Clipper fans call them the cardiac Clips, the comeback Clips, is because they just make it so difficult, but they usually pull through in these types of scenarios, unlike teams in the Lob City era, unlike teams in 22 and in 2020. So, you know, for whatever reason, I'm cautiously optimistic of that. But in terms of the X's and O's, there's really not much else you can adjust to. Like the Mavericks went with a super aggressive push type defense where they were just hounding James Harden and Paul George and giving them no space. And that kind of threw everything awry. And now, you know, you have to, on offense, the Clippers didn't really get it to Zubats in the second half. They didn't really move the ball a lot. It was a lot of ISO basketball. The Mavericks played very fast on offense. Luka looked like he wasn't even hurt, and maybe he was just saying all that stuff. I don't know why he said any of that stuff that he was sick. It didn't look like it at all. We got to understand, like, this Mavericks team at home, they're so good. That Mavericks crowd is so good. So you have to weather that storm, much like you did in the first half of game four when they were up by 17 at the half. I'm not saying you have to get to that level, but if you if you're in the game going into the fourth quarter, if you're within five, well, even within 10 going to the fourth quarter, or up five or up 10, that's a great spot for you. You just have to stay close and let your closers close. And that's the biggest issue with game five that I saw, was that they just weren't close enough to even get back into the game. So if you can stay in the game within 10, I think they have a good chance going into the fourth and closing it out, because we just saw it happen in game four.
Yeah, there's something about Vegas though. Like I think that spread's too high. But then I'm like, man,
that's wild.
Why?
Well, yeah. there's something to note too about that game. Once Kawhi was ruled out in game, what was it, four or something, right? Or five? Yeah. No. What was the game they won in Dallas? That was five.
Was four. And then, yeah.
Oh, four. My bad. That was four. Game five is the one they lost. The actual spread was, like, once Kawhi was ruled out, was about 10 or 11. And the Clips won as dogs, right? Yeah, like, so. And there was analytics that was saying that the spread should have been 19. Like, that's crazy, right? Like, so 7.5.
That's crazy. That's nuts. Well, because here's the weird thing. No, the weird thing is that the Clippers' best game, like, up until that point was game one without Kawhi. And then it was very clear, and we all said it, that probably Kawhi shouldn't be playing. I think Kawhi probably held them back in games two and three. So, like, in normal situations, then I could see a fluctuation in the point spread to that degree. But I think everyone had seen through three games of the series that, listen, unfortunately, Kawhi is not himself. Just sit him out. And again, like the way that these guys played in game one was the way that they played in game four. That I think that's why game five was so surprising to so many people, that it's like, you guys have proven what you can do without Kawhi. I'm not saying that you should win, but you shouldn't get blown out at home to that degree. Brandon, Grant touched on it, and we've talked about it. Like if this series goes the way of the Mavericks, whether it's in game six or seven, I don't think that they have a lot of pathways to improve the team by blowing it up. I agree that they probably will run this back just because you're not going to find a better player than Paul George. You're probably going to get Harden and Westbrook at a hometown discount. I don't know where they're going to go. So I think that this group's going to be brought back probably. What do you think that they will do, and what do you think that they should do?
I think that they will bring back everybody. I don't think they should. I think they will. I think George is back, signs an extension, going to become one of the worst contracts in basketball. I mean, it just is. He's getting older. He's got creaky knees, too. They both do, him and Kawhi. And James Harden, you can't trade him. So I think what they're going to do is maybe Westbrook's gone. I don't know. Joey Lynn's been pretty quiet on Twitter ever since the last couple of games.
I think he put out a tweet that I think Ty Lue said that he should have played him more or something. I mean, again, no, like, listen, we'll
be honest. If he played him more, they'd be down the they'd already have lost the series. No. That guy's been horrible. He's been atrocious. And it's so sad to see all-time greats kind of deteriorate right in front of your eyes. Because, like, 4 out of 32 over the last 4 games is horrible. Yeah. Like, I'm sorry, poor guy.
No, it's the struggle is real, no doubt about that.
Can I say something about Russ? I like this whole narrative, like, Brandon, I get that, but like, it's not his athleticism that's declined. Like, this guy can still dunk at the, like, with his head at the rim almost on James Harden lobs. It's his hands. Like, his hands are, I don't know if he had broken hands a few years ago, if he's had multiple injuries to his hands. It's kind of a weird situation, because even when he was with the Lakers, it seemed like his hands got progressively worse. And I don't know if there was a major injury to them, but he cannot grip the basketball around the rim like he did in his OKC days and like he did in his Washington Wizards days even. Like, it's just so weird because he still has the athleticism, and sometimes it comes out of him where you're just like, this guy's 35 and he's jumping at the rim, but his efficiency is so bad because it's just like his form is off with his jump shot. It's like his hands are bad. I don't get what's going on.
He's been hanging with Quinn and Johnston too much.
Oh, the Chargers.
From the Chargers.
Yeah, that's pretty funny. I wanted to get you're both, Grant, I'll just start with you first. Although you guys both experienced Patrick Beverley being on your respective teams, although with the Clippers, he was a fan favorite. Man, just a bad night overall for Patrick Beverley, throwing a ball. I don't think he meant to hit the two girls, but like, you can't do that, obviously. But he threw the ball into the crowd twice. And then the way he came after a female producer, basically asking her if she subscribes to his pod, and she said, you know, no. And this really odd behavior. Apparently he phoned the producer and apologized. I don't know to what extent he's apologized to the fans. The league will obviously suspend him. But I mean, listen, this behavior is just this has become a trend with Pat Bev, right? And as you remember, Grant, remember during the Clipper-Suns series where he pushed Chris Paulick in the back, and I forgot how many games he was suspended. I think it should be a big number. You cannot throw the ball the way he did into that crowd. The behavior towards the producer was bad, but I don't think that will be part of the suspension. But your thoughts on Pat Bev?
Yeah, listen, you can never act that way, especially when you get eliminated. It just looks a lot worse. And especially for a guy in Pat Bev that now has his own podcast. And you know, he's been talking a lot of talk about a belt to ASS to a lot of these teams.
Yes.
And, you know, I'm not really sure why he acted that way, because, you know, he gave his respects to Indiana on X with a post. But listen, whenever you go at fans like that, especially when you're getting, when you lost and it's a disappointing season, and look, the Bucks had a flame out in the first round. I think we all get away from that with this whole Pat Bev situation. That was a massive failure of a season. And to have that be kind of the last look on that team for this year is a really bad look, especially when you're going after, you know, by what I've seen, a very nice woman that tried to report on and a woman that's respected in media and sports media. And just because she doesn't subscribe to your podcast, and there are other people that were on that X post that were quoting and saying, look, he's done this to us all year. Like, this is just her. And now he's said, like, hey, I don't want to hear your questions because you're not subscribed to my pod throughout the whole year with the Bucks. So it's a bad look, not just for him, because look, I've always been a fan of Pat Bev and his play style. And while he is dirty at times, like when he's on your team, you love him. And I know Laker fans don't love him, but when he was on the Clippers, like, we loved him as one of our own because he brought that grit, that mentality, that hardworking play style. And he was great within the community. He supports the guys still now to this day. And it's just unfortunate that he did. I hope this doesn't affect his contracts going forward. Like, I hope a team doesn't see this and say, yeah, well, you did this at the end of the season, I don't want to sign you. Probably not, just because he's so, like, the Bucks got way better defensively with Patrick Beverley. I think people get away from that. He's still an excellent, like, team guy when he's on your team, but it's just a bad look. You can never interact with fans that way. Like when Draymond was screaming at the Kings fan, it's just such a bad look.
Yeah, it really is. It was really low class type of attitude. And I've always been a huge stand up for Pat Bev kind of guy. And it was really tough to see because you can't stand up for stuff like that. That's ridiculous. Like, just because she's not, I mean, regardless of the throwing the ball, which was, I mean, he'll get suspended at the start of next season for sure. I mean, that was ridiculous. I don't care if they're, whatever they're calling you, you can't assault fans, okay? Mm. You just can't. You can't. You go to the, what's been going on for years, Arash? If a fan is saying something racist or horrible towards them, they go to the security and they ask to take the fan out of the stadium.
Yep.
You don't go in and punch fans like Meta World Peace, right? Like Malice at the Palace or throwing stuff. You don't go throwing stuff at the fans. That's first off. Yep. The second thing, what really made me even like more mad at him was the whole you're not subscribed to my podcast. So like, I'm not going to let you ask me questions. I'm not going to let you do your job because you're not supported in my, that's just like, that's ridiculous. That's weird.
Yeah. Listen, it's one of those things where Pat Bev, unfortunately, he gets a certain way. A lot of times, we heard about the reports with Michelle Roberts, in the bubble, and Michelle Roberts with the NBPA, the Players Association, really disrespecting her and having Chris Paul and other players basically say, no, man, you're way out of line. And so in a situation like that, the league obviously has to get involved. The interesting thing is that there is a track record here. And so because of that, we have seen the league come down harsher on Draymond because this is not his first time doing it. Like, and again, the important thing with Pat Bev in relation to the fans, he really threw the ball hard into the crowd, which is effectively, not a punch, but you're not, it would be one thing if he's screaming at the fans. He did something physically to the fans. I mean, when a ball strikes a fans in the face like that, you might as well be hitting them, which you can't do. He did it twice. So hoping that the league comes down hard just to be like, listen, we know you're intense. We get that, but this cannot happen. Real quick, want to get your guys' thoughts. It's pretty clear at this point that the Lakers will be looking for a head coach. One of the, you know, again, Ty Lue was a coach that they wanted the first time around when they got Frank Vogel. I think Grant Mona would be happy if Ty went to the Lakers. Real quick, both of your thoughts. Grant, Ty to the Lakers, would that be a good thing?
Sure, go ahead, take him. Listen, I mean, the Laker fans and the Lakers in general, I don't think any team really likes their head coach. Like, maybe Greg Popovich, but like, if you go to any Twitter space or X space and you go to that fan base's pages, they're all like, oh, I want this guy out of here. And they could be like the best coach in the world. So I don't know. I think it's more about roster construction. I know they need a new head coach, but like, if you bring in Ty Lue, he's still going to have a good roster to supplement. I do like this, Brandon. JJ Redick. I like that.
Oh, I was going to say it. You stole it.
Well, what do you think?
I don't want to say it. JJ Redick, I would love it. I mean, I think he'd immediately become a top 10 coach in basketball, and he knows LeBron. I think that's the most important point, like, because you can't, a guy like, let's say, Nick Nurse could never coach the Lakers because he was a no-nonsense guy, and, you know, LeBron has kind of, he's earned the right to have his ship and do what he wants, and some coaches aren't cool with that. I think JJ is a coach that would fit in perfectly. Rondo, assistant coach. That's what I want.
That is interesting. But you bring up a great point. You have to have a coach in place that LeBron respects. That's why Luke Walton was on the hot seat from the moment LeBron got there. I mean, that was not going to be a head coach that LeBron paid attention to. So Phil Handy, Ty Lue, JJ Redick, again, perhaps they could do the podcast during the season. That would be a heck of a thing. Yeah. All right, guys, you're the best. We'll have a lot to get into on Monday after these crucial Game 6 and potentially Game 7. When we come back, speaking of Game 6 and 7, we'll talk to Lindsey Brown, breaking down VGK, the Vegas Golden Knights. Are they going to get eliminated by the Dallas Stars? We'll see about that when we come back right here on the Mightier 1090 in Southern California, the Bet in Las Vegas, and the Hawaii Sports Radio Network.
We'll be right back with the Arash Markazi Show on the Mightier 1090 ESPN Radio.
Time. There's nothing more valuable. It's what drives everyone to make the most of every moment. We celebrate living large in the now, in a city where time disappears. We create experiences that electrify the soul and memories that will last forever. We go big, we go all night, and here, everyone is invited. So get loose and get loud.
This is Circa. You'll have the time of your life.
This is the Arash Markazi Show on the Mightier 1090 ESPN Radio.
Welcome back to the Arash Markazi Show, presented by the Sporting Tribune on the Mightier 1090 ESPN Radio in Southern California, 98.5 FM in Las Vegas, and the Hawaii Sports Radio Network, 95.1 FM and AM 760 in Hawaii. Just as a reminder, if you have a question or comment, or just want to win tickets to an upcoming game in Southern California, Las Vegas, or Hawaii, call our hotline 310-400-0340. All right, let's not waste any time. I talked about two big game sixes here. In the first segment, we talked about the Clippers and the Dallas Mavericks. Now we're going to get into the Vegas Golden Knights and the Dallas Stars. And no one better to break it down than our good friend, Lindsey Brown. Lindsey, how are you?
I'm doing great. Really excited for tonight and hoping to see the Game 6 turn into a Game 7, just like how the Maple Leafs are able to push things with the Boston Bruins.
Exactly. I mean, I think you probably agree with me. There's no postseason, there's no playoff better than the Stanley Cup playoffs, because despite the fact that the Vegas Golden Knights went into Dallas to win the first two games of the series, I think anyone who watches hockey and certainly watches the Stanley Cup playoffs knows or knew that it was far from done, and now Dallas has won three straight, and obviously Vegas is hopeful that they can force a Game 7. What has changed? Again, the turning point, perhaps, obviously, Game 3, Logan Thompson plays the best game of the postseason, perhaps, of his life, and Vegas cannot find a way to win that game. What kind of changed in the series with that Game 3 loss?
Well, I'll tell you, there's something about the psychological impact that a game and a loss like that can have. Because as you mentioned, Logan Thompson was masterful, probably the best game I've ever seen him play. But the Golden Knights, the guys in front of them, really didn't have any business being in that game in the first place. I mean, they've struggled really ever since then. And this is a team that shockingly is struggling with cohesion right now. This is a lineup that only started playing with one another, you know, in game one of this series. And one of the most glaring things that I've seen in terms of the little adjustments that have been made. And let's remember, if you're making adjustments, that usually means your team is together. They're able to communicate. They're able to implement things at a quicker way. I always say there's coachability in terms of listening and being open to it. And it's another thing to apply it. And with the Dallas Stars, it seems like there is a mandate after game too, that, hey, how about we stop running around and hitting people into oblivion? Why don't we stop playing into the Golden Knights' hands? Because if you look at the hit totals throughout every single game, the Golden Knights have at least thrown 41 hits in the world. And early on in that series, it was 55-55. And the Stars were willing to play ball there. They were going with 31 hits and 54 hits in those game one, game two, respectively, but have cut that in half since game three, game four, game five. And that's, they have a lot of young speed on that team in Dallas. And as good as the Golden Knights are on paper, as much talent as they've been able to bank for whatever reasons that they've been able to do, they just haven't really been able to keep up with Dallas, whether that's in response time or in getting zone to zone. This team is struggling to make passes right now. And that's just not the level of math that you want to be doing right now. You're asking for calculus level mastery in the playoffs. And right now they're having trouble with arithmetic.
Your thoughts on the decision to go from Thompson to Hill? I think everyone obviously remembers the amazing run that Staten Hill had during the Golden Knights run towards the Stanley Cup. But when you make a decision like that, how hard is it for a team to adjust? How hard is it for a goaltender to adjust? Your thoughts on that decision in game five and the plan in game six?
Well, as you know, Arash, I used to play goalie. And so this is a very sensitive subject because it's a tough pill to swallow when you have a game like Logan Thompson did in game three, but then get taken out for game five. But I want to point out just how these goals have been scored, because Logan Thompson, like every goalie, has strengths and weaknesses. He's a guy that's very springy. He's very explosive. He's very long. But he compacts himself in order to achieve that explosiveness that is certainly, I think, a benefit in today's league, where you're seeing so much east to west play where you need to get across. But they started aiming for his ears. And this is a team that is very well scouted. I could tell that in the game one breakaway with Jamie Benn, where he waited for Logan Thompson just long enough to coil his legs to push across, then to slide it five hole. Everything's about timing and when you can catch goaltenders. And you can catch Logan Thompson with the poor post player integration, which is kind of how you're setting your body up to cover that post. Now, like I said, Logan Thompson, being an explosive athletic goaltender that he is going to almost always look to try to put himself in position to push across. But that means there's going to be holes up and down that post, and they kept aiming for his ears. And when you're giving up goals that are damn near at the goal line with the butt to the boards, that is so demoralizing to the team in front of them. Those are pucks that you have to have. That's not something you can change mid-season. It's a philosophy. And so there's a lot of different adjustments that you could look to make. But at the same time, this is a team that is trying to cover up holes on the fly here, right? And so I wasn't really offended with the movement towards Aiden Hill. There's not as big of an adjustment for the team in front of them, other than you're expecting probably some different chances from different places. But to be honest, the goaltender is dealing with the sins and the triumphs of the people in front of him. And I don't think the Golden Knights have played well defensively, especially from their decor, which has been the strength of this roster, at least through their championship iteration.
Can you describe what it's like? I mean, having played the position, you know, being in the zone, I think that's one of the beauties of the Stanley Cup playoffs, being so very unpredictable. That one position, in terms of if the goaltender is in this zone, and I was very lucky in 2012 and 2014 to cover the Kings when they had Quick, and it was just nothing that could get past him. Again, the Vegas Golden Knights won because Hill was just playing like out of his mind. To describe that feeling, and again, it's very like unpredictable. Like, you never know when it's going to happen, I guess.
Well, and it looks differently on the outside versus what's going on in the inside. Let me tell you about the psychological warfare that is that position, because you have to be constantly looking to live in that moment, and it's hard to do. It's hard to not get ahead of yourself. It's hard not to let a goal kind of get you down, especially if it's one that you'd like to have back. And that's what, you know, goaltenders were trained to do from a young age. You're trying to achieve this very zen-like mode where you're just letting things come to you. You're seeing it, you're tracking it, your movement is integrated, your mind can become clear, whether it's the greatest save you've ever made in your life or it's the worst goal against that you've ever had. And it's very elusive. Like, as much as you can set the table and and have all of these exercises, be that mental, physical, what have you, it doesn't always sit down for dinner, if that makes sense. And I think the best example of someone who we thought the table was set perfectly for was Connor Hellebuyck with the Winnipeg Jets. He's going to win the Vezina Trophy. He had an unbelievable regular season, but then he couldn't stop a beach ball in the playoffs because the Colorado Avalanche got him on a tilt in that game one. Winnipeg was still able to win it, but they got 6 goals against. And once you kind of see that, once there's blood in the water, I used the example the other day, it's like Bruce from Finding Nemo, right? He gets a sniff of blood and all of a sudden the eyeballs go all black and we're having fish for dinner tonight. And when that happens, it's so hard to hold on to that end of the rope. But you just, it's all about the practice of goaltending and believing that even if you just gave up that awful goal, that the next one is going to be different. Like the next one is going to start that streak. And you just kind of have this acceptance of whatever comes to you. What you get into trouble is when you start seeking it out, when you start pushing, when you start getting too aggressive. And that's something that I think Logan Thompson can struggle with. I think any goalie can. It just means that they get off of what makes them them. Like if I see Aiden Hill outside of the blue paint and pushing people around after or before the whistles are blown. If I see him, you know, on his butt more than usual, it's something that is very common for him too. Like 2 or 3 times a game, he's going to end up on his butt. But if it's more than that, I can tell that he's not fully within himself and that he's fighting the puck a little bit. And so it's tough. You never know when it's going to hit. You never know when it's going to end, but it's all about that acceptance that goalies have no friends. Your life sucks and you're going to eat pucks for.
You touched on cohesion. Oh, I'm sorry. You touched on cohesion. It has been very hard for this team to be cohesive this season, as you know, just because they've never truly been healthy. How has that really prevented this team from being the team that they thought they would be again as the like gate seed? They clearly wouldn't have been that low if they were healthy this season. But again, health has been very elusive for them. How has that hurt them this season?
Well, I think the most glaring example as it's manifested, I can tell in game 5 is through the neutral zone and on zone entries into the offensive zone where you have a lot of people slowing up at the blue line to wait for the puck carrier because you can't enter the zone before the puck does. That's offsides. But you can tell when teams are moving through zone to zone, as I said, when you're connecting with passes, when people have good gaps, they have good timing. A lot of times in hockey practice with the kids, sometimes they're all going down one lane. They're the same depth and they're wondering, why aren't we scoring? Well, there's absolutely no threat there. It's an easy, disruptible play. And what I noticed with Dallas did is they started sending bodies up high on those zone entries. They were having like 3 bodies in the high offensive zone, basically acting as a screen. And it disrupted the Golden Knights to the point where sometimes they didn't get in the zone. And then if the hockey gods did bless them with a well-timed onside play, they would just pull up within 6 feet of the blue line. The most vulnerable place on the ice is 6 feet on either side of either blue line because that's a zone where people are expecting that puck to go down low. Your defense haven't really set up. Maybe they're going for a change. Regardless, if that puck gets turned over, that's probably an odd man rush situation. That's probably a situation where people's skates are facing the other way. And so it causes a bigger challenge to get back in that play. And so when I see that, it just disrupts everything. And they haven't been able to drive the puck down low. And even if they do get it down there, it's just kind of like one little shot and it goes right back out. There's no zone retention. And you have to have zone retention in order to grind down the legs of your opposition. And I think that's what Dallas has done historically, regardless of who their coach was, whether it was Rick Bowness a few years ago or Jim Montgomery or Pete DeBoer right now. It's that they're so tough to play from the hash marks down. And that's a game that the Golden Knights have been trying to get to all season. But as you mentioned, the injuries have really prevented them from relying on the harder parts of hockey. You gravitate more towards rush chances. You gravitate towards defensemen stepping up in the play, which is fine as long as you finish. Otherwise, your defenseman's putting his defensive partner or their defensive partner in a precarious position. Hopefully the forward is covering, but they're not meant to be the defenseman. And it changes the way you can play gaps, changes the way you defend, all of these things. And so this cohesion has so many little tentacles to it, but the most glaring example is just watching how they move and seeing if they can take zones with authority. And I haven't seen it for most of this series and most of the season, quite frankly.
thoughts on momentum, like in a series? Again, obviously Vegas had it at the beginning. They won the first two games, but now can that momentum be broken if Vegas scores first, for example, in game six, gets the crowd involved? What's your thoughts on momentum in this?
Well, we all know that if Mark Stone scores a goal, it just gets the people going in a different way, right? And the thing is like those goals are great boosts, but they only go so far, and goals are a lot harder to come by than maybe your more traditional hockey fundamentals, where if you're making a great tape-to-tape pass or you have a good, a well-timed hit, like those are things that you can go to the well. It's not as potent, but it's actually more sustainable in growing your overall game, and that's where there's a challenge out to the Golden Knights, I'm sure, from Bruce Cassidy to play that hard way, to endure in their defensive zone, not just chase around, block shots, which they've been, you know, masterful at for a number of years, but especially last year. And you'll always have me advocating for that big save. You make a big save and then you push down to that other end, because you'd be surprised how many goals are the result of a big time save that's being made. And so hopefully whoever's in net tonight, I'm not sure who they're going to go with. I don't see why you would go back to Logan Thompson, because I don't think Aiden Hill played poorly the other night. If the Golden Knights lose this series, it's not going to be because of their goaltending. It's because they haven't been able to execute. And in the moments where they have got chances, Jake Ottinger has been able to step up. But it's just when you don't have that interior pressure, when you don't have that enduring zone presence, those chances are going to come against fresh legs. They're going to come against a goaltender who's locked in, who's not being challenged. And so it's just harder to get the job done.
When a team wins a championship, you know, the general thought of the GM is to kind of bring back the majority of that team, give them a chance to defend their championship. And again, as we touched on, they've been hurt this season. If their season comes to a close in game six or game seven, and they're done in the first round, do you expect big changes for this team? Because again, obviously big difference between winning a championship and saying, let's run this back, to being like the final seed and you're like done in the first round. What are some of the changes you foresee if this team's run does come to a close?
Well, big changes are kind of inevitable. This past off season was kind of the run it back season, where the only player they really exchanged was Riley Smith. But otherwise, you have Jonathan Marchessault coming off the books. You have Chandler Stephenson coming off the books. You have William Carrier coming off the books. And when you have players like that going off in free agency, it doesn't mean that you can't ask them back. But then when you make trades for Noah Hanifin, signing him to a long-term extension, and then taking on the long-term deal for Tomas Hertl, nobody expected that Hertl deal to be done. I was shocked the day of, and it might turn out to be one of the greatest trades they've ever made. Like, I'm not saying that, but it certainly tightens the strings of the money bag when it comes to your ability to re-sign Jonathan Marchessault. I think Chandler Stephenson's probably going to ask for too much. He'll walk. I think they'll try with Marchessault, but he's 33 years old. He's one of the hearts and souls of this team, but he's earned a big contract, and there's nobody with a better story of basically coming from the bottom, paying his dues in the AHL, being kind of passed around in the NHL, and then finding a home here, and obviously going on his Conn Smythe tear last season and carrying that over into this year. He's going to command a pretty penny. And so I think it's about how long these deals are going to be for that I think is going to be the biggest thing, but it's going to be really tough. The way that I've kind of figured out a way, and I'm not a numbers person. I got hit in the head with too many pucks, that in order to give yourself a chance to sign Jonathan Marchessault, I would look into trading somebody like Shea Theodore. I think Shea Theodore is a great defenseman. He's had a really tough year. He's had a tough series, but he's still young. He's 28 years old. He has a favorable number at $5.2 million, and it wouldn't be a true rental, or it'd have one more year left on that deal. And so I think he would be someone that you would look to move, especially with the depth that they have at the defensive position. You know, I have guys like Kaden Korzak have been knocking on the door for a long time. I'm a huge fan of Lucas Cormier, who's down in Henderson. He's a little bit of a smaller guy, probably a couple more years out. But you have to be able to leverage that cap space. And so this front office has done it the best, or at least the most aggressively than I think the league has ever seen. But they're also very cognizant of people's value and how ages time out. And so there's going to be a lot of changes to this lineup, whether they move on or are eliminated. It's just how incentivized are you to re-sign some of these players if they don't go on a longer playoff run, and kind of I don't say prove their worth, because I think that's inherently already been done, but kind of solidify that they need to be part of this team going forward if they want to extend this championship window.
Lindsay, the last couple of minutes, I want to touch on the Kings with you, because that's the other team that we cover, and the Ducks.
Heck
and,
yeah.
Yeah. Listen, I think these past three seasons, like, everyone's been very excited about the progression of this team, and they've gone up against the worst possible team matchup-wise in Connor McDavid and the Edmonton Oilers. 3 years ago, it was a 7-game series. Last year, it was a 6-game series. This year, it was a 5-game series. Nobody wants to see this team next year in the postseason. They need a goaltender. They have to get, but again, they're happy with the rebuild, but they have not seen the postseason success. What do the Kings have to do to get over this hump, I guess?
Man, it's a great question, because you could say that they're ahead of schedule. They've been one of the more manipulative teams when it comes to kind of expediting their window. When you had players like Alex Iafallo and all these other, that generation that kind of got sent off to different places, not because they weren't great. I don't think they were game breakers by any means, but you had to make room for guys like Philip Deneau. I remember when that signing was made, I'm like, this is amazing. This is a direct shot across to the Golden Knights and Mark Stone. But then the last couple acquisitions with Kevin Fiala, who I watched a lot in Minnesota, that's where I'm from. And then obviously Pierre-Luc Dubois. Kevin Fiala doesn't score in the postseason. Like, if you look at the numbers I saw the other day, it was like 3-18 games. Maybe it's 3-19 games. He works hard. He plays with an edge, but he has a propensity to take stupid penalties. Same with Pierre-Luc Dubois. I don't think anybody had in their mind that they wanted the guy who they just signed to a max deal to be down on the fourth line in the first round. And so I think what has to happen is you have to see this kind of this improvement from the Quinton Byfields, from the Alex Kalyevs, and have that kind of how the Stars have been able to manage, where all of a sudden the younger generation starts hitting. Instead of hitting when you're supposed to, they get ahead of schedule. And then goaltending has been an issue. And that organization used to be the team that produced the best goalies, right? It was Jonathan Quick. I was obsessed with Jonathan Quick back in the day. Still am. Yeah. But and Martin Jones. And you had all these guys. But it just seems like that pipeline is dried up. And it's hard to find goalies at cheap numbers that can perform, because it's such a volatile position. You're great 1 year, and then the next year you're garbage. And the third year, I think that's kind of when you get your game back. It's a 3-year cycle for me. But it's tough. There's just a lot of talent in the West and a lot of talent in the Pacific Division.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, I think, been loving the way that they've been slow building it, and hopefully they can progress as well. Lindsay, would love to have you back on again. The Ducks, the annual tradition, they'll be in the lottery, so we'll see who the Anaheim Ducks can get. Lindsay, you're the best. Looking forward to have you back on the show soon. That's all the time we have for today, folks. Until next time, this is Arash Markazi. Be safe, be healthy. To live in
Don LA, this is the Arash Markazi Show on the Mightier 1090 ESPN Radio.
Thank you for listening to Believe. You can show support to your host by subscribing to the show and giving us a 5-star rating on your preferred platform. Check us out at Believe.com and search for BLEAV on YouTube.